Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, before veterans in the swing state of Ohio, President Bush announced the largest global realignment of the U.S. military since the Cold War.
The world has changed a great deal, and our posture must change with it for the sake of our military families, for the sake of our taxpayers, and so we can be more effective at projecting our strength and spreading freedom and peace.
The president's plan would move thousands of U.S. troops out of Germany and cut back troop presence in Korea and Japan over the next decade. The reductions would not affect current troop levels in Iraq, where the American death toll is closing in on 1,000, or reservists and National Guard units serving long extended tours there. Tonight on Point, shifting America's troop presence worldwide, the strategic and political implications of the biggest realignment of global forces since the Cold War. Can you picture Germany without all those American bases? Korea without American GIs staring across the DMZ. Is this master strategy in a new era or election year politics? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Andrew Koch, Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly. Andrew, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I know you've sat in on the Pentagon briefings where they filled in a bit of what the president had to say today. What exactly is known about what's being proposed here, Andrew?
Well, unfortunately today they didn't unveil a whole lot. They're very light of details. But it's come out over the last 6 to 9 months that the Pentagon wants to shut down as much as 50% of its facilities in Europe and shift to the maximum degree they think possible, at least in the political sense, forces closer to the Middle East. They see that as really the area that's going to be the hotspot for the next decade, two or three, and therefore they want to have, at a minimum, the right to use bases as close to those hotspots as possible.
President Bush today talked about these moves primarily in terms of bringing troops home, not shifting them closer to the Middle East. What exactly is meant by shifting closer to the Middle East? What did he mean by bringing them home?
Well, he did say that they were going to move two divisions from Germany back to the United States. However, there will be some a smaller force going out to Europe to replace them. And they what they're saying is they're going to keep forces in Europe on a rotational basis. That is, rather than have them permanently stationed there, the forces that will be in Europe would be rotated. So maybe, you know, a unit from Texas would go for 6 months and they'd be replaced by a different unit on a rotating basis, rather than having a dedicated force that's permanently stationed in Germany.
So a lot of troops still away from home. When you talk about shutting down 50% of the U.S. presence in Europe, what does that mean in concrete terms, Andrew? Does that mean large-scale closures of bases in Germany and elsewhere? Can you put any meat on those bones?
Well, the Pentagon hasn't put any meat on the bones, so it's very difficult to say. They've said that the main air base at Ramstein, Germany, won't be closed. And they've said a few other facilities wouldn't be shut down, but they haven't said which ones would be. But since Germany has the predominance of the U.S. facilities in Europe, if you take a sheer number of 50%, most of them would have to be located in Germany somewhere.
And what about in Asia, in Korea, in Japan?
Well, what the U.S. Bush administration is not saying, but what people inside the Pentagon are, is that the U.S. is going to look to draw down its forces in South Korea and shift as much as it can from the continental United States or Hawaii closer to, again, what it sees projected hotspots in the future, that is either North Korea or the Taiwan Straits. Principally, the island of Guam could base a number of new U.S. forces there. Some more submarines, possibly some surface ships, and possibly even the B-2 bomber.
Of course, Guam is not as close to North Korea as South Korea is. Why pull U.S. troops out of that delicate area now?
Well, I think over the last couple of decades, U.S. military started to feel a little bit encumbered politically by what's going on in South Korea, because Seoul is so close to the border and demand for real estate in Seoul is so high. U.S. bases that used to be located out away from the city have now been submerged by it, and there's obviously some very steep operating restrictions put on the U.S. military when they have to operate within such a heavily populated city as Seoul. So that's part of it.
And, Andrew, when you talk about the president and the Pentagon wanting to shift troops closer to the Middle East, what does that mean geographically? Where?
Well, if you listen to the leaders of in the U.S. military responsible for the coming up with at least the broad blueprint, what they're saying is they don't want to have permanent bases. They want to have the ability to build them when they need them, where they need them. For example, now you have them, U.S. using facilities in the Central Asia. Those are not permanent facilities as such. They don't expect the United States to be there for 20 years. But clearly they needed to have them to do operations in Afghanistan, and we, even after the Taliban fell, the United States forces stayed there and are still operating out of there.
And of course, you could say the deployment in Iraq is a very large deployment near the Middle East, into the Middle East.
Absolutely. And again, they're not saying the future disposition of U.S. forces in Iraq. At this point, they're claiming it would be up to the Iraqi government to decide that. But clearly, they want to have troops located, as close to within flying distance as possible. Also, they're looking at using some of the former Soviet bases that had been built and are many of which are largely mothballed in places like Romania and Bulgaria.
And Andrew,
possible staging grounds.
Let me ask you, how are people receiving the timing of this announcement? It's being received by Democrats as political. In military circles, is it seen as political or long overdue?
Well, the thinking on this has been in the works for a long time. However, clearly the decision to release it right before the election and the way at which it was released certainly gave off a lot of political feelings there.
The veterans of foreign wars receiving this, welcoming this, or being shocked by the idea of these long-time Cold War front lines being abandoned or depleted?
Well, I think the problem is at this point there's so little detail that's being offered that people don't really know what to think. For example, they say that the Bush administration claims that it's going to lighten the load on the average military family by bringing them back from Germany.
And they're talking, about 100,000 family members and civilian personnel that would come home.
However, when those family members are in Germany, they're close to their loved ones who are in the military. Now, when these troops go on rotation to Europe, they'll be very far away. So the net assessment of how this will affect the military until the details are available, it's really difficult to say.
And the rapid deployment factor that seems key to all this, President Bush describing, saying we can pull back but be ready to surge forward. We now have this capacity that wasn't available before. Does that ring true?
Well, I got to say, at this point in time, that's more of an idea and maybe a plan than a reality. The fact is that during Iraq and during previous wars, the U.S. has always had a transportation problem. It couldn't get enough stuff, either people or equipment or the spare parts to keep them going, forward to the war area fast enough. And clearly, if there's only so many planes and so many ships that you have, so that if you bring things further away from the areas that you expect to have a conflict, it's going to be more difficult in terms of transportation. So, are they going to come up with the money to buy the additional planes and additional ships to get stuff there quickly? It doesn't exist today.
All that raises a lot of issues in itself. Andrew Koch, stand by if you would, please. We're joined now from New York by Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. He was Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, 94 to 96, Chief Architect of the Dayton Peace Accord in the Balkans in 1995. Ambassador Holbrooke, thank you for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
You are now a foreign policy advisor to John Kerry, so you've got an iron in this fire. But what do you make of the president's announcement today?
Well, my own view, and I speak here as a former Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and as a former ambassador to Germany, is that this is bad for our alliance politics. It's a unilateral announcement. It's a substantial withdrawal. The allies were notified but not consulted. And I think it weakens us. I'm particularly puzzled in regard to Korea. where they intend now to withdraw 25% of the troops in face of a ongoing and very delicate negotiation with a country, North Korea, that really does have weapons of mass destruction, unlike Iraq. That isn't any way to negotiate.
We'll look at Korea, but what about Europe first? It is a long time now since the wall came down, the Soviet Union fell apart. Isn't there a point at which those troops in Europe ought to be moved, redeployed, might be more usefully deployed somewhere else?
I think your question presupposes that there haven't been any withdrawals. In fact, your question is wildly off base. There were almost 400,000 American troops in Germany at the time the wall came down.
And now?
There are about 75,000. The drawdowns have been gradual and continual. When I was ambassador, we oversaw three base drawdowns. These were done in a slow, methodical, low-key way. The troops originally were in Germany to protect West Germany against the Soviet Empire. That rationale, of course, disappeared in 1989. Ever since then, the remaining troops have been there as a forward deployment to go into places like Balkans, mm-hmm. Bosnia, Kosovo, mm-hmm. Iraq, Afghanistan. Even dramas in Africa. It's a vital forward base. The Germans, and I don't think your listeners may understand this, the Germans pay $1.5 billion a year to support these troops. The Koreans and the Japanese also pay billions a year. The president today said there's going to be a saving to the U.S. taxpayer. That is not the conclusion of every military person I've talked to in the last few days, nor is it the conclusion of the Congressional Budget Office.
So if there's no savings, if there's already been a substantial drawdown, if we've had the support from the German and Japanese and Korean treasuries, how do you interpret what President Bush is doing today, what he's announcing?
A continual adjustment of our forces on a specific case-by-case basis is naturally appropriate. For example, one of the things Bush announced today is that we're going to take the troops out of the center of Seoul where we hold a golf course. We should have done that 10 years ago. But this kind of massive withdrawal at this time is bad for our alliances, and I can only assume that there's some political motive. After all, he made the announcement in a political campaign stop paid for not by the White House, but by the Republican National Committee at the end of a speech in which he attacked directly and continuously his Democratic opponent. This is no way to make major national security announcements of such a monumental importance.
What do you think it means for long-term U.S. relations with NATO allies, with East Asian allies?
I don't know. Let's see. They aren't going to be very happy.
Really? Because maybe they don't think they need these U.S. troops anymore.
You haven't been reading the German press, which is full of leading politicians and local officials in all the states where this is going to happen, asking the Americans not to leave. Now, it's slightly different in downtown Seoul, where the South Koreans want that land back, which, as I said, we should have given it back a decade ago. These countries, which are paying billions of dollars to support the American troops, want the American troops. They want American leadership. President Bush is weakening our national security, not saving any money, and doing something unilateral at the wrong way at the wrong time in the wrong place.
We've just got 30 seconds left. Is the bottom line for you, then, that it was done without enough consultation with these allies, that the drawdown itself is not such a problem, but simply the way it was done?
No. Let me repeat. It's the wrong drawdowns at the wrong time in the wrong way, and if you're going to make drawdowns, small ones occasionally, fine. That's been happening for years. But to do this, a massive drawdown, and to pretend it strengthens our national security, when in fact it's a response to the political pressures they're feeling and to the stretched-thin presence of our military in Afghanistan and Iraq and around the world, this is not good. And I'm particularly concerned about Korea. What a wrong signal at what a wrong time.
Ambassador Holbrooke, thank you for joining us tonight.
It's my honor. Thank you.
Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and for East Asia. Andrew Koch, please stay with us. We are talking tonight about shifting American troops globally. You can join the conversation. Can you picture Germany without all those big American bases? Korea without the massive presence of American GIs? Is this the real end of the structure of the Cold War? Is this the acknowledgement that we really are in a new era? Or is this politics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about shifting America's troops globally. President Bush calling today for a major realignment of U.S. troops worldwide. You can join our conversation tonight. Does President Bush's plan make you feel safer or not? Does rapid deployment of American troops from home anywhere in the world sound realistic now? Is this really about shifting troops to feed the need in Iraq? Is it really about politics, allowing President Bush to talk about bringing troops home? Speaking today at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Cincinnati, President Bush said tens of thousands of U.S. troops will be withdrawn from Europe and Asia.
We will bring home about 60,000 to 70,000 uniformed personnel and about 100,000 members and civilian employees, family members and civilian employees. See, our service members will have more time on the home front and more predictability and fewer moves over a career.
President Bush in Cincinnati before the VFW today. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Andrew Koch. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly. And with me now in the studio, Barry Posen, Professor of Political Science at MIT and on the faculty of the Security Studies Program there, author of Inadvertent Escalation. Barry Posen, thanks for being with us.
Good evening.
You just heard Ambassador Holbrooke in his inimitable fashion remind us that there have already been a lot of drawdowns post-Cold War. What do you make of what President Bush is announcing today, Barry Posen?
Well, I think you have to distinguish between the substance and the process of what's occurred and the timing and the rhetoric that's associated with it. The substance and the process has a strategic rationale behind it. It's been going on for many months. It's not the sudden preemptive or peremptory announcement that Ambassador Holbrooke implied. You can debate the strategic rationale behind it, which we can do, but nevertheless, there is one. Now, the timing and the rhetoric is something different. I think the president was looking to announce something that, you know, sounded like he was bringing some boys home from somewhere, and he can't bring them home from Iraq right now, so there's some in Germany that he can say that he can bring home. He can use a rhetoric of efficiency and effectiveness, whether or not that rhetoric makes any sense at all. The truth is, as Ambassador Holbrooke said, that at the peak of the confrontation with the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, the United States Army had almost 17 brigades, major units of combat power in Germany, and we're down to our last four. And of those final four, I think they're really going to withdraw three and transform one into something else. You may say that that's unreasonable, but it is a bit peculiar for the president to make it seem like this is, you know, at last someone's confronting the fact that the Cold War is over and it's time to pull these troops
out. So George W. Bush will take action when everyone else laid around.
The Clinton administration took this action a long time ago. And Ambassador Holbrooke is right to say the Clinton administration left troops there because they thought it would be a good jumping off point for those troops. But whether that gain is worth some other cost you pay is debatable.
And Andrew Koch, what about the idea of taxpayer savings that the president hit here a couple of times? Do you see savings in this plan?
Well, whenever they close down bases historically, savings, if they come at all, has always been in the far future. There's, generally speaking, actually more cost associated over the short term, and then over the long term savings comes. Now, in this specific case, again, because they haven't said what exactly is going to be closed and what isn't and where things are going to be consolidated at, it's hard to begin to take a true accounting of what's going on. If it's simply reshuffling the deck chairs, then probably are not going to be savings. If it's truly trying to gain efficiency through consolidation, then over the long term, some efficiencies might be possible.
And Barry Posen, so here we are coming down to one brigade or one big, division, unit.
It's essentially two division headquarters. Each one only has two brigades right now forward in Germany. Normally they would have three. They're going to bring those division headquarters back, I think, along with the four brigades. And then as a kind of a symbol that we're not, you know, entirely
abandoning
Germany. They're going to put back one brigade, they say.
And you're saying this has all been wrapped up in a kind of grandiose rhetoric. It was more or less on the rails already. But yet, going down to one brigade in Germany, that really is sort of the end of the Cold War deployment, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we've been slowly letting the air out of the NATO balloon, you know, since, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed, and we're still letting, you know, the air out. NATO is turning into something else. What is turning into, we're not quite sure.
Well, does this knock the legs out from underneath NATO? Ambassador Holbrooke, again, saying unilateral, not done in full consultation with the Europeans?
I probably share Ambassador Holbrooke's political views, but I think in this case that's probably not fair. I mean, it looks to me like they've talked about this with the Germans a lot. When Ambassador Holbrooke said the Germans are against this, the Germans who are against it are
the
town mayors who profit from these payrolls.
Right.
I mean, Germany itself, from a strategic point of view, does not really depend on these four brigades. That said, there's a larger issue here, which is as American combat power leaves Germany and leaves NATO's European premises, as it were, the salience of NATO in the strategic life, if you will, of Europe is going to diminish. And we've been fighting against that by trying to create special units and special command structures and special exercises and whatnot. And we have a nice, you know, rhetoric going on in NATO and some actual programs. But I think facts are facts. Material facts, you know, are symbolic of political facts.
And we simply won't be on the ground in the same way.
We're not going to be on the ground that much, and that's going to influence the way NATO works every day. And that's inevitable.
Andrew Cook, I know I've just got you for another minute. Do you see this as related to the obvious strain on the U.S. military that Iraq is creating? Does this somehow give them some breathing room? Does it eventually put more troops in the pipeline for Iraq? Is it related to the stress of the Iraq occupation?
I don't think it's related to Iraq. This review began right after the Bush administration came into office. I think if anything, it has to do a little bit more with the post 9/11 world, where they saw the need for conflict or the likelihood of conflict going on for quite a long time, and the need to reposition the U.S., you know, either basing or at a minimum the rights to use territory for things like spy aircraft and unmanned drones, to reposition them closer to where they think the action is going to be.
And that's the next shoe to drop here today. Andrew Cook, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Andrew Cook, Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly. We're looking tonight at a major shift of American troops. Well, presented major. It is major, but been in the pipeline, perhaps we're being told, longer than the rhetoric today may have indicated. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Michael's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling, Michael.
You bet. First of all, I have to tell you, I was there when the president spoke, and he got no less than four standing ovations, and one of them was when he announced the troop withdrawal.
So you were at the big VFW convention in Cincinnati.
Yeah, I'm a delegate on my way back to Massachusetts, as
okay,
we speak.
Okay, great, yep.
And there are a number of things. I agree with the gentleman that just spoke, the man from Jane's Fighting Weekly.
Yes.
I think Ambassador Holbrooke is being more political in his own head than reality. First of all, when George Bush, 41, was president, there was a lot of talk about scaling down, and it's been going on for decades. And the reason being is, for instance, when I was in, the whole method, the whole mythology is so very, very different. And the way that you deliver your military and how you deliver your punch is so very different.
Masses of tanks before needed to be there in the way of the Soviet troops, and now we're talking about long-range deployment.
Right. We were talking about what's commonly referred to as static deployment. But there's also a downside in this new war, or the new kind of war we're facing with terrorism. When you have static deployments, you also have targets that become terrorist targets, which can lead to all kinds of political interpretation or whatever.
Michael, let me ask you something. You were there today in the hall when President Bush announced this, and you say this. He got a standing ovation from the VFW people. Why exactly? What is it that would bring that enthusiasm up out of the VFW crowd for this announcement?
Well, he had four standing ovations. This was just one of them.
Yeah.
For one thing, the VFW, at least my colleagues and the people I talked to, we've agreed for a long time, and we actually do our own studies, and we've said, you know, we need to bring more people home. We need to have a speedy, rapid delivery type of military, because things have changed. So we don't, you don't have people anchored in the way they used to be. And the Clinton administration, they did away with three divisions because they felt that we didn't need that kind of power. And also something has come in which is known as the total force concept. And for the first time in the Republic's history, since we had a standing army, which really, I think prior to World War II, we had like three infantry regiments in the United States Army. We had a Marine Corps and a Navy.
Pretty small, yeah.
World War I necessitated the forming of the United States Army in a standing army complex with its complexity with divisions, et cetera.
Right.
And, but we don't do it business. You don't fight wars that way anymore. And the other thing is, if you've got more troops based at home on garrison-type duty, it's much easier to protect them and to protect your assets at home than it is in a foreign country. Because in a foreign country, I don't care what country it is. I mean, you never know who the enemy might be. For instance, take Iraq, downtown Iraq today. You go by places in Baghdad.
Oh, well, Iraq, of course. But, of course, cozy Germany may be a little different. But, Michael, we've got the picture, and we appreciate your report right there from the convention today. Drive safely, and thanks for calling in. Barry Posen, here's the news. Standing ovation from veterans for the president's announcement.
Well, I mean, I can imagine some of the reasons for it. I mean, there is a peculiar aspect of military life that may be improved by this this redeployment, and it's one that veterans have a very keen feeling about, and that is the strange aspect of family life that has emerged in the 1990s, where you have troops that ostensibly are deployed to Germany, and of course now they all have families and they take their families with them, and the idea is the family will be close to the troop. But then the troop is deployed from Germany to Bosnia or from Germany to Iraq.
So they're not with their loved one or at home.
They're not at home with, in American society. They don't have their own extended family to call on for support. So it's almost the worst of all possible worlds. Mm. And if you think that's likely to continue, and there's reason given the strategy of the Bush administration to think that it will, then it does provide some important relief. And I think this other point that was raised about vulnerability to terrorism, I think it cannot be discounted entirely. I mean, I wouldn't want to stress it too much, but it's true that American soldiers on what was believed to be garrison-type duty have been the victims of terrorist attacks. And, of course, you have a large family structure there in Europe and relatively open society, so these people are somewhat vulnerable. So you can understand why this idea of reducing the footprint abroad would have a certain amount of emotive appeal for a veterans group.
Barry Posen, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation now from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Lieutenant Colonel Raymond Millen. He's Director of European Security Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College, served as the Army Infantry School Liaison Officer to the German Infantry School, 98 to 2001, was an intelligence analyst in the Balkans, 93 to 96. Lieutenant Colonel Millen, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So your take on the president's announcement today, an earth-shattering big deal, or it's been in the pipeline and it's being wrapped up for a political season?
Well, it's been in the works for a while, at least a year. We've been discussing this throughout the defense community, and it's no surprise to Europe. I think in concrete terms, the value of NATO for U.S. national security strategy is pretty much diminished over the last 10 years. And, when you look at from the United States perspective, what's the incentive for us remaining or keeping our troops there? Our allies are not making a greater effort to make meaningful contributions to the alliance, and hence it's not really worth our commitment to Europe to maintain the troops there.
So you've got an even bigger message here, which is kind of writing off NATO. Is that implicit in the president's announcement today?
I think whether he means it or not, I think over time NATO is going to be reduced to a defense form. The integrated military structure that we know of today is probably going to wither away over time. And I don't think that's necessarily the United States' fault. I really put the blame on the European allies for failure to contribute to their own military forces.
And you speak from some experience having been over there. You're saying they didn't step up, and so the United States may as well pull back, and nothing's lost in the process.
Right. What's keeping us there? That's really the only incentive to keep us in Europe. Financially or power projection-wise, it's better for us strategically to project troops from the United States.
Very posing. How about that? The time has come. Europe hasn't really stepped up. Why should the U.S. keep hanging in there? What about that view?
Well, I think this notion of Europe not stepping up is a bit of a caricature. The United Kingdom and France both maintain very significant military forces. The rest of the Allies are probably spending 1.5 or 2% of GDP on defense, which is not nearly what we spend, but it's not trivial. If you compared the military efforts of Europe to military efforts anywhere in the world, you would find that Europe looks like a pretty impressive and imposing operation. If you add up the total naval surface combatants of the European allies, you'll find that they have more than we do. They have less tonnage than we do because their ships are smaller. They have a large number of ships, and they've made those ships available to the Americans for a lot of patrol duty that we've been doing to try and deal with terrorism. There are European forces in the Balkans. There are European forces in Afghanistan. There are European forces in Iraq. So, the Americans complain that the Europeans are not arms racing with America, but we don't want the Europeans to arms race with America. It's not accurate to say that the Europeans don't allocate significant resources to defense, and it's not to me strategically wise to imply that they're worthless as allies. In fact, they're still very useful as allies. And I think Ambassador Holbrooke's concern is that through this action, as well as many others, some acts of omission, some acts of commission, we're accelerating the rate at which these countries are not going to want to be associated with us and are not going to step up. And that's too bad for us, because it's clear from the scarcity of American ground forces in Iraq that we, in fact, still do need friends.
So you're unlike Lieutenant Colonel Millen, you're saying we need an operational link between among these NATO allies?
I think it's an asset to the United States, a strategic asset to the United States. It's a very hard strategic asset to sustain, because the real glue that held this alliance together was this very large and imminent Soviet threat.
Yeah.
But there are shared interests and there are shared problems in the world today. Europeans are also concerned about terrorism. They're also concerned about proliferation. Now, you have to deal with them in a different way, and you can't get quite the cooperation you once got, but it's reasonable to try and sustain it. And the question is whether this particular action today did more damage to that process than, nature is doing anyway, because there's no Soviet Union to hold us together.
Colonel Millen, are you essentially saying good riddance, no problem?
Well, I look at it more pragmatically. There's a contract among the European allies, or the NATO allies, and that's that they contribute a minimum of 2% of their GDP to military expenditures. They have failed to do that within the last 10 years. We've begged them, we've cajoled them, done everything possible to try to get them to step up to the plate. But really what the real long pole in the tent is that they are not contributing the logistics and the support troops necessary for these deployments. In fact, only about 5 to 10% of their forces are deployable, and they can't sustain that. It takes really an act of parliament in Germany to deploy a grenadier company to outside of Germany, and that's just no way to do business if you're attempting to react to crises.
Can't keep up with the speed of the preemption-ready U.S. of A. Colonel Millen, Barry Posen, please stand by. We're talking tonight about shifting America's troops globally. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this really about politics, about allowing President Bush to talk about bringing troops home? Can the United States truly be as close to Europe without those troops in Europe? Does it matter? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about shifting America's troop presence globally and what it means for American security. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you picture Germany without all those big American bases, Korea without the massive presence of American GIs and military families? Do you hear more time together in this announcement or not? Is this move, its timing, ultimately about global strategy or domestic politics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Lieutenant Colonel Raymond Millen, Director of European Security Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College, and with me in the studio, Barry Posen at the Faculty of Security Studies at MIT. Right now, Curtis is calling from Sparta, Wisconsin. Hi, Curtis. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Well, I go back to your question, and about whether it was a political move or whatever for him to make this announcement.
Yeah.
You know, your guests this evening are all military savvy, and they understand exactly what he said. But most of the populace out here don't, and I've talked to a lot of them. I'm retired after 27 years, 15 years of that spent in Germany.
In the U.S. Army, Curtis?
In the U.S. Army, correct.
Okay, yep.
And the way the announcement came out, it made it sound like, oh, we're bringing home our deployed soldiers.
Yes,
well,
it did.
You know, it's really a terminology thing. Those guys are assigned over there. They're stationed there. Deployment to most people in the military is they're deployed in Iraq, Kosovo, Bosnia, wherever they may be.
So you're saying
they don't have their families with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's not bringing home anybody that's crucial. As a matter of fact, they talk, is it going to free up anybody? Well, guess what? All the troops in Germany right now are in Iraq. So we're not freeing up anybody. As far as the families coming home, being able to better protect them, yeah, there is an argument there. But I'll tell you, as a leader, we really discouraged our family members from leaving Germany and going back home because we had more contact with them. We have what you call family support groups in the Army. And in Germany, they're very robust. You get lots of participation, and people are well taken care of.
Curtis, let me ask you something.
Yes.
Your deployment or your posting in Germany, I think I know U.S. military for whom that's actually a kind of an incentive to be in the military, a posting in Germany or maybe Japan.
If I wouldn't have done my first 3 years in Germany from 76 to 80, I'd never made a career of it.
Join the Army, see the world, and it let you do that.
Nope, I told them I didn't want to go to Germany, and I didn't want to. I wanted to be a diesel mechanic, so they sent me to Germany and made me a tank mechanic. And I retired as a brigade command sergeant major, so I had a good career.
But you don't see a major shift in this announcement today. Curtis, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call here. Bonnie is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Bonnie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and
Hi.
To your guests. Well, I wondered, since I've heard that the United States is building a really huge base in Iraq, and given the fact that a second Bush administration may well have its foreign policy informed by the Project for a New American Century, whose aims, as far as I know, are to spread democracy throughout the Middle East and elsewhere by the use of military force.
Okay, where are you going, Bonnie, with that?
Might not. After a Bush reelection, in a year or so, all these troops that are allegedly going to be withdrawn from Germany and Korea be in bases all over the Middle East or wherever else the administration wants to go.
Just shuffled elsewhere and not necessarily home. Let us pick that up, Bonnie. Thanks for your call. Colonel Millen, how about it? As this is worked through the system, the announcement made today, plans that have been on the rails for a while, does it ultimately lead, in the absence of a major war, and we've got one on our hands at the moment, but in the absence of that, does it lead to more U.S. troops on the mainland of the U.S. or just reshuffled around the world?
I think basically to the mainland of the U.S. It's easier to project power from the United States. The main force for projecting power really is your maritime power. That's where you get the bulk of your logistics. That's the only way your heavy units, that's your armored and mechanized divisions, can deploy. And so the United States is the best place for that. We have fast sea ships, which are designed specifically to deploy heavy units globally quickly, very quickly.
Very posingly, I put the same question to you. Do you see the balance of U.S. troops swinging homeward? And to Bonnie's spin on this, with the kind of aggressive military face the Bush administration has shown in its first term, how does that bode for the balance of U.S. forces?
Well, I think it's, I mean, given that you have this large deployment in Iraq, we don't know where it's going to end. Given that we have very tense relations on nuclear matters with both Iran and North Korea, anybody who's sure that most American troops are going to somehow be in North America over the next 5 or 10 years rather than somewhere else is a bold person indeed. I think their hope is that they can bring most of the ground forces somewhere in North America. If you read the fine print of some of the things they've said about this deployment, this redeployment, they're hoping, I believe, to position ground forces, sea lift forces, airlift forces in base structures that are close to each other so that you can get your ground forces into a deployment mode very quickly.
This is from the U.S.?
From the U.S. Okay. I think this is their hope.
Mm-hmm.
Their image is of a world that's full of possible threats, but a world where you can't exactly guess where the threat's going to be. So what you want is the largest possible strategic reserve that you can then dispatch in any in one of several ways as quickly as possible. So they'll live here at home in as much comfort as you can make it for military life, but they're going to be ready to go, and they're often going to be going.
Does that sound like a workable strategy to you? Does that sound like the right strategy? Does it make the country safer?
To some extent, with these, particularly with these ground forces, you're dealing at the margins of the total capability. I mean, the United States military active, if you count the Marines and the Army, has about 40 brigades, and we're talking about bringing 4 or 5 of them home, right? The rest of them are usually living here. Right now, they're mainly living in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's not a gigantic shift of the location of American ground forces. The more important question will be, where do these ground forces go and what happens to existing ground forces in the United States? This is all connected to another big study that's going on in the United States, the base realignment study, right, which has to do with shuffling a lot of American troops around the United States, which is going to cost...
What will stay open, what's going to be closed?
Yeah.
And Colonel Millen, we haven't talked enough about North Korea. Our time is short. But there's a nuclear threat there. We're talking about pulling some troops out of South Korea. How does that work strategically?
I really can't talk about the Korean Peninsula because I'm really a European analyst.
That's fair enough. Let me put it to Barry Posen then. You heard Ambassador Holbrooke say, how can you pull back from South Korea when you've got this delicate situation on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, I think, as a first approximation, it's a good question. This is a case where I do have a stronger suspicion that this is driven by the scarcity of ground forces. They just need a brigade. They just need another brigade.
In Iraq or Afghanistan.
In Iraq or Afghanistan. I think that's part of it. Part of it is, a kind of an esoteric idea that has to do with the repositioning of our forces within Korea. And there's a notion there that moving our forces back from the line of contact makes our coercive leverage greater because our forces at least initially are less vulnerable to the North Korean stock and trade, which is artillery and rocket fire.
So they can't be hit quite so easily.
That's right. And I think they've also been trying to convey, I think, an impression to the North Koreans that if things get really bad, the United States can come after them in ways that they haven't thought about, that we're not necessarily coming across the demilitarized zone, that mm-hmm. there's other ways into North Korea, which there are.
They're, from a distance.
They involve amphibious assault and all mm-hmm. kinds of other fancy mm-hmm. stuff, which mm-hmm. is risky, but nevertheless may convey an image to the North Koreans of an America that is not necessarily constrained in its military action by its relationships with the Republic of Korea. And this is all very esoteric and very speculative, but nevertheless, you hear things like this.
Well, a fascinating conversation tonight, an evolution already underway, and much in the presentation, the venue of the presentation to the veterans today, the rhetoric of the presentation that cinches in with the presidential campaign season. Lieutenant Colonel Raymond Millen at the U.S. Army War College, thank you so much for joining our conversation tonight.
Thank you.
And Barry Posen, professor of political science at MIT on the faculty of the Security Studies program there. Great, as always, to have you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good to be here.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, one fan longs for the Olympics of old. This is On Point. It has been a bit of a rough start for the United States at the 28th Summer Olympics. The heirs of the Dream Team lost to Puerto Rico in basketball. Superstar swimmer Michael Phelps could only manage bronze today in the 200-meter freestyle, soundly beaten by Australia's Ian Thorpe. This is a day after the men's 4x100 freestyle relay team posted its worst finish ever in the Athens pool. For Massachusetts resident Joan Wickersham, the biggest disappointment with the Olympics hasn't been her home country's upset losses. It's been all the hype and commercialization. In this radio diary, she says she longs for the days when the Olympics were about the competition, not the commercials.
I'm not sure if the Olympics used to be more innocent, or if it's just that I was. I was thrilled to see Olga Korbut come out of nowhere and literally catapult herself into fame when she did her backflip on the uneven bars. Or to watch Joan Benoit in her plain, unlogoed white cap running quietly away from the pack to win the marathon. I even thought it was exciting when Mary Lou Retton got her picture on the Wheaties box. But there's something about the level of hype accompanying these Olympics that's really bugging me. I find myself wondering which will garner more airtime, Michael Phelps' swimming races or his Visa and AT&T commercials. Phelps came into the Games under enormous pressure to win 8 gold medals, surpassing Mark Spitz's 7 in the 72 Games. He's been on the cover of Time magazine, and all summer he's been staring out of NBC's Olympic promos with an I mean business look on his dripping face. We know now that Phelps won't surpass Spitz, but as NBC is already pointing out, he could still come away with a higher overall number of medals than Spitz. I feel sorry for Phelps, as sorry as it's possible to feel for a 19-year-old with 7-figure, multi-year endorsement contracts. If he wins 8 medals and breaks world records, he'll just be doing the job his corporate sponsors are already paying him millions to do. If he does anything less, even ending up with several golds, he'll be something of a disappointment. This kind of prepackaged hype isn't limited to Phelps, or even to the Americans. The other night, NBC mentioned a former Chinese gymnast who now owns the largest sporting goods company in China. Then the camera focused in on the current Chinese men's team as the announcer intoned, "Now, tonight, it's their turn." It was unclear whether it was their turn to score a 9.9 on the pommel horse, or their turn to start building their own sporting goods empires. Or maybe it's the same thing. I don't mind that athletes in formerly obscure sports are starting to make money. But what I miss is the old feeling that the Olympics were about love, not money. And what I find myself responding to over the last few days aren't the big pre-scripted moments, the races that come out the way they're supposed to, but the unexpected triumphs, like the radiant smile on the face of American swimmer Caitlin Sandineau when she took the bronze medal in the women's 400-meter freestyle. For a country that supposedly loves reality TV, we have a lot of trouble just letting the Olympics unfold spontaneously. At their best, the Olympics are the ultimate reality show. This year, you have to wonder which reality show we're talking about. Are we watching athletic competition, or are we watching people scrambling to become corporate moguls? If Michael Phelps loses one of his individual races, is Donald Trump going to point at him and tell him that he's fired? I was in the supermarket yesterday, and I checked to see who's on the Wheaties box these days. It's Carl Lewis, the track and field star who won 9 gold medals over the course of 3 Olympics. Remember when he seemed like the height of hype and commercialism? Now, compared to Michael Phelps and his omnipresent commercials, Lewis seems nobly dedicated to pure sport. Almost, but not quite, an amateur athlete. Maybe the Wheaties people are nostalgic for a time when heroes seemed to be made at the Olympics, not just marketed there. Maybe they didn't want to be another jewel in Michael Phelps' crown. Or maybe they just couldn't afford him.
Joan Wickersham is a writer and a regular contributor to On Point. She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.